Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Phil Dierking, Alice Bryant, and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Phil Dierking.
After the execution of Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu in 1989, aid groups visited the country's many state-run orphanages. All were shocked by what they found. Rupert Wolf Murray is a British reporter. He traveled with aid groups to an orphanage for disabled children. There was no heating, no windows, no bedding, no running water, he said. It was overcrowded and under-supported. The aid workers also found orphanage records. They showed that in a single year in the 1980s, 30 children had died of cold, starvation, and disease. Similar conditions were discovered at tens of thousands of other Romanian orphanages. It is a different story today. About 7,000 Romanian children now live in Romanian orphanages, compared to more than 100,000 under Ceausescu. Around the world, governments and private groups are working to get children out of orphanages. The number of children in orphanages is not confirmed. The United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, estimates the number is about 2.7 million.
In the past, Eastern Europe placed children in orphanages at the highest rate in the world. Now, it is the center of the movement to empty them. In Moldova, Europe's poorest country, the orphanage population has dropped from 11,000 to 2,000 since 2011. Aid groups did this by reuniting children with parents and establishing foster care services. Neighboring Bulgaria used family-style care centers to remove children with disabilities from state institutions. UNICEF says the Bulgarian orphanage population dropped from about 7,500 in 2010 to fewer than 1,200 children today. Across the Black Sea, Georgia has had even more success. It reduced the number of state-run orphanages from 50 to 2. The number of orphans dropped also from 5,000 in 2005 to about 75 now, UNICEF says. However, Romania has made the largest improvement. The European Union has provided millions of dollars in aid to support Romanian child welfare reforms. Private aid agencies like Hope and Homes for Children have helped place children with foster families or smaller homes where they experience a more usual childhood.
Ștefan Darabuș, Hope and Homes regional director, says Romania's next goal is to keep at-risk families together. This helps the children and costs the state less money than an orphanage placement. In Russia, however, child welfare reforms have been slower. After a 2014 Human Rights Watch report found cases of abuse with disabled children in state-run orphanages, Russia created policies to help these children stay with their families or go to family-style centers. According to Russian officials, the number of children without parents has decreased almost 50% in recent years, from about 126,000 in 2011 to 66,000 in 2016. However, there has not been a major increase in adoptions. Historically, the Russian government has controlled orphanages. Now, for the first time, a private orphanage exists to care for children with severe disabilities. St. Sophia's is run by a Russian Orthodox church in Moscow. In the past, few Russian families adopted children with conditions such as Down syndrome or cerebral palsy. But St. Sophia's has placed at least 3 such children in adoptive homes.
In China, most orphans are children surrendered because of medical issues. Many families, especially in poor rural areas, cannot support a child who will face high medical costs. Chinese babies with medical problems would often be left alone in fields and other public and private places as a result. In 2011, China responded with an experiment. The government established so-called baby hatches attached to orphanages. The hatches provided parents a safe place to leave children they could not care for. However, many of the programs were suspended after being flooded with hundreds of children. China now wants to place such children in family settings. Last year, China had about 460,000 orphans. It cared for 373,000 of them through foster care or adoption. Only around 88,000 children went to orphanages. Still, the number of adoptions in China has steadily fallen from 44,260 in 2009 to 18,736 last year.
I'm Phil Dierking.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. We have all been there. It's 3 o'clock, and you've been hard at work. As you sit at your desk, a strong desire for chocolate overcomes you. You try to busy yourself to make it go away, but it doesn't. In fact, the more you try to not think about a square of deep, dark chocolate melting in your mouth, the more you want it. You can even smell it. Here is another scenario. Perhaps you are not feeling well. You're coming down with a cold and feel run down. The only thing you want to eat is a big bowl of chicken soup, like your mom used to make when you were sick as a child. A food craving is a strong desire for a specific type of food. And they are normal. Most people have them, even though what we crave might be different. One person might crave sweet chocolate, while another might crave salty potato chips. Sometimes the foods we crave are not super healthy ones, but rather fatty or sugary foods. Or sometimes we crave foods from our childhoods, like American meatloaf, Polish pierogies, or Vietnamese pho. Other times the cravings may be for something healthy but very specific, such as Japanese sushi or Korean kimchi. But where do food cravings come from? And how are they different from hunger? Scientists at the website How Stuff Works Compare hunger and cravings this way. Hunger is a fairly simple connection between the stomach and the brain. They even call it simply stomach hunger. The website explains that when our stomachs burn up all of the food we have eaten, a hormone sends a message to one part of the brain, the hypothalamus, for more food. The hypothalamus regulates our most basic body functions, such as thirst, hunger, and sleep. The brain then releases a chemical to start the appetite, and you eat. A craving is more complicated. It involves several areas of the brain. These areas make up the reward center of the brain. A craving can also be tied to our mental state and memory. So some scientists call cravings mind hunger. Scientists add that while hunger is a function of survival, cravings are not. People often crave foods that are high in fat and sugar, and not foods that can keep us alive. Foods that are high in fat or high in sugar release chemicals in the brain. These chemicals give us feelings of pleasure and even mild and temporary euphoria, much like a drug. Back in 2004, researchers at the Monell Chemical Senses Center and the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine studied food craving and the brain. They used functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, to show that food cravings activate brain areas related to emotion, memory, and reward. These are the same areas of the brain activated during drug craving studies. The lead author of this study was Marcia Levin Pelchett, a sensory psychologist. She says that the finding of the study is consistent with the idea that cravings of all kinds, whether for food, drugs, or designer shoes, have common mechanisms. They work the same way in the brain. Food cravings, drug addiction, and addictive behaviors such as gambling and overshopping follow similar neural pathways. Studies show that our mental state affects our food cravings, but not really our hunger levels. Also, our food memories affect what we crave and when. For example, if a child is given sweets when he or she feels sad or upset, that may lead to food cravings for sweets later in life. The reward system in the brain may lead us to seek out familiar pleasures. In a 2007 study, researchers at Cambridge University found that dieting or restricted eating generally increase the likelihood of food craving. So the more you deny yourself a food that you want, the more you may crave it. However, fasting is a bit different. They found that eating no food at all for a short period of time lessened food cravings. So, the next time you crave food from your childhood or have a hankering for something very specific, know that your brain may be more to blame than your stomach. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the presidential election of 1804. Thomas Jefferson, the nation's third president, was easily re-elected. Jefferson was head of the Democratic-Republican Party, known today as the Democratic Party. Thomas Jefferson had a very good record during his first term as president. He ended many taxes, he paid government debts, and he gained possession of the huge Louisiana Territory from France without going to war. His political opponents were the Federalists. The Federalists were sure Jefferson would win the election of 1804. Still, they were surprised by the strength of his victory. Jefferson won 162 electoral votes. His Federalist opponent won just 14. In the early 1800s, Britain and France were at war with each other. The United States remained neutral. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says President Jefferson did not want to become involved in a war.
He was sufficiently pro-French that he didn't want to ally with the British, but not so pro-French that he wanted a war with the British.
Jefferson also believed getting involved in a European war would destroy all the progress he had made at home. His economic policies had helped to pay much of America's national debt, and he was able to reduce taxes. But staying neutral was not easy. The United States was having trouble with Britain. For many years, Britain had been taking men by force to serve in its navy. Britain claimed the right to seize any British citizen anywhere. The custom was called impressment. Conditions in the Royal Navy were not good at that time, and many sailors deserted. Some went to work on American ships. The American ships were stopped and searched in British waters. Anyone born in Britain was seized. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says sometimes American citizens were also taken.
There was also still something of an imperial attitude in Britain towards America. You know, they were still insisting that some American citizens had been born British. It was often difficult for them to be able to distinguish between their own subjects and Americans.
Several thousand sailors were taken off American ships during the early 1800s. In 1807, an incident made relations between Britain and America even more tense. Britain believed that four of its sailors had deserted and fled to an American ship called the Chesapeake. The United States said the men were American citizens who had been forced to serve in the British Navy. The United States refused to return them. When the Chesapeake sailed out of American waters, the British ship Leopard tried to stop and search it. The American captain would not stop. First, the British ship fired two warning shots. Then it fired all its guns directly at the Chesapeake. The American ship could do little to defend itself. The captain surrendered. News of the British attack spread quickly. President Jefferson ordered all British Navy ships in American waters to leave at once. He told people not to aid the British. He said any person, American or British, who disobeyed his orders would be arrested. In response, the British government announced a new rule. It said any American ship sailing to Europe must stop first in Britain to get permission. Ships violating the rule would be seized. Relations between the two countries were reaching the breaking point. Impressment was just one of the major problems the United States was having with Britain in the early 1800s. Another problem was trade. Britain wanted to stop the United States from trading with France and its colonies. British warships blocked the port of New York all through 1805. No American ship could leave without being searched. Any ship found to be carrying goods for France was taken north to Halifax, Nova Scotia. There, a British court had the power to seize the goods and force the ship's owners to pay a large fine. In the closing days of 1807, President Thomas Jefferson signed a bill banning all trade with Europe. No ships could enter or leave the United States. Jefferson did not believe that trade embargoes were the best way to settle America's problems with other nations, but at the time, he thought an embargo was the only way to deal with Britain and France short of war, and he did not want war. Jefferson later explained why he thought the embargo was the best choice of action. He said, if American ships had sailed out of American waters, they would have been seized by Britain or France. That would have forced the United States into war. Jefferson said it was far better to stop all contact with these nations until they returned to some sense of justice. Jefferson acted to protect American traders, ship owners, and sailors. Yet those were the people who protested the loudest against the ban. They were willing to take the chance of having Britain or France seize their ships and goods. They could not make any money without trade. The situation quickly turned into a political battle between the Jeffersonian Republicans and the opposition Federalists. Federalist newspapers attacked Jefferson. They called him a tool of France and its leader. They charged that Jefferson supported the trade ban to help Napoleon Bonaparte. One Federalist senator wrote a pamphlet against the embargo. He urged northeastern states to refuse to enforce it. Then he went even further. He met secretly with a British official who was sent to Washington to discuss the situation. He told the British official that Jefferson would be forced out of office because of the embargo. Jefferson simply wished to give the trade embargo a fair chance. He considered the embargo less evil than war. But after a time, he thought, this will not be so. If the war should continue in Europe, and if Britain and France continue to act against us, then it would be for Congress to say if war would not be better than the embargo. Jefferson hoped that the loss of American trade would force Britain and France to change their policies toward the United States. And he hoped the change would come quickly. He knew that the American people would not accept a long ban on trade. A British traveler visiting New York City described what the embargo had done. The port is full of ships, but all of them are closed. Only a few sailors can be seen. Many of the counting houses are closed. The coffee houses are almost empty. The streets near the water are almost deserted. grass has begun to grow upon the docks. America's northern industrial states felt the loss of trade most deeply. But the agricultural South also was affected. Rich southern farmers and planters suddenly found themselves poor. Tobacco was one of their major crops, and Britain bought more American tobacco than any other country. Because of the embargo, the price of tobacco fell so low that it had almost no value. The price of wheat fell from $2 a bushel to 7 cents a bushel. Good farmland dropped in value until it was worth almost nothing. Opposition to the embargo was growing. The opposition was strongest in the Northeast. Ship owners and traders believed that the embargo was wrong. They continued to export goods secretly. Some traders began sending goods over land to Canada. From there, the goods were sent on to Britain. Congress passed a law against this kind of trade, but the shipments did not stop. Too many people were willing to violate the law for the large amounts of money they could make by trading secretly with Britain. By August 1808, Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin had lost all hope that the embargo would be successful. Gallatin told President Jefferson that the embargo was defeated by open violations. Another of Jefferson's supporters gave the president some advice. If the embargo could be enforced, and if the people would accept it, then I am sure it would be the wisest course. But if it cannot be enforced completely, and if the people will not accept it, then it will not serve its purpose and should not be continued. Jefferson, however, was not ready to give up his plan. In his last State of the Union message to Congress, he painted a bright picture of the nation. He reported that American industry was making progress. Many goods that had been imported before the embargo were now being made at home. He said almost all of the national debt had been paid, and he said more than 100 gunboats had been built, enough, he declared, to defend the country. Jefferson said nothing about opposition to the embargo, nor did he talk about the serious economic problems caused by it. He said only that Britain and France still refused to honor American neutrality, and so the embargo must continue. The rest of the nation was not so sure. Congress began debating a number of proposals to either lift or amend the embargo. In the first months of 1809, Congress finally approved a bill. The bill lifted the ban on trade with all European countries except Britain and France. Jefferson had hoped to continue the embargo a little longer and with more powers to enforce it. He was not satisfied with the final bill, but he signed it anyway on March 1st. 3 days later, the 15-month-old embargo was dead, and the United States had a new president.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.